Welcome to Just Us and the Climate, a podcast by the Climate Justice Coalition, where we bring climate change back down to earth and show how it's not only a crisis, but an opportunity to build a better, more just world.
Good day, it's Alex Lynn-Ferner here, Secretary for the Climate Justice Coalition, and we have a very special episode of our podcast, Just Us and the Climate, today. The Climate Justice Coalition were thinking we really needed to do a podcast focusing on the struggles against oil and gas exploration up and down the eastern and western coasts of South Africa. And it just so happened that the Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies, PLAS, at the University of Western Cape, did this most fantastic discussion featuring communities on the front lines of struggles against oil and gas exploration. And so he thought, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and do what they had done so perfectly, that we would just collaborate with them and bring you that discussion. So thanks to PLAS, thanks to WC, thanks to Living Landscapes in Action and Oak Foundation, who helped bring that discussion together, we're able to bring it to you on the Just Us and the Climate podcast. So without further ado, I'm going to turn over to that discussion. Thank you.
On the topic, we cannot eat oil and gas. Seismic surveys on the east and west coast of South Africa. This webinar is located within the Living Landscapes in Action research project funded by the Oak Foundation to promote nature conservation that benefits local communities, in this case, ocean conservation for the benefit of coastal communities. The legal battle in the courts between coastal communities and big corporations is ongoing, if not far from being over. On the East Coast, an interim interdict was granted by the Grahamstown High Court in Makanda on 28 December 2021. On the West Coast, an interdict was granted by the High Court in Cape Town on the 1st of March. We will reflect on these judgments in this webinar. By the way, the year 2022 is the year of the artisanal fisher. It is an honor and pleasure to introduce the following speakers. All of them were part of the current litigation processes in the High Courts to challenge seismic surveys. Our speakers include Nondle Ngutuma from Amadiba Crisis Committee, Sinegu Guzukulu from Sustaining the Wild Coast, Vinmin Wilkom from Legal Resources Center, Christian Adams from Fishers United and the South African Small Scale Fishers Collective, and Muniba Isaacs from the Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies at the University of Western Cape. Nondle Ngutuma, one of our speakers, is the spokesperson of Amadiba Crisis Committee of the Kolobeni community situated on the Wild Coast in the Eastern Cape. The committee was formed in 2007, and it is fighting for community land rights and the environment, as well as trying to ensure human rights are not violated in the name of development. Sinegu Guzukulu is a dynamic, inspiring, and deeply motivated educator, social and environmental activist. He was born on the Mpondoland Wild Coast, a place of deep significance in his life. He is against imposed development while favoring bottom-up, locally induced human-scale development that will be beneficial to people. Christian Adams is a fourth-generation fisher in Steenberg Cove, St. Helena Bay, on the West Coast. He represents the Fishers United and the South African Small Scale Fisheries Collective. He has been actively involved in many positive changes regarding the livelihoods and rights of small-scale fishers across the globe and internationally, including within the UN and FAO. Vilmin is an attorney and co-lead in the land program. She joined the LRC in 2009 as candidate attorney. Since then, her practice has specialized on issues of African customary law and community governance systems, in particular as it relates to community rights to natural resources such as land, fishing, and other extractives. She is active in both litigation and policy and law reform to further the democratization of rural communities, ensuring the equality of customary communities and enforcing their rights to determine their own development path. She has published on law and complex systems, customary law, the right to development and free, prior and informed consent in the African continent, and the rights of women living under customary systems. Muniba Isaacs is a full professor with the University of Western Cape Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies. She submitted a supporting affidavit in a matter between Kristen Adams and Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy. Her work on small-scale fishing communities in South Africa spans over 25 years. She also works extensively on the continent in small-scale fisheries and has started the movement to call for blue justice for small-scale fisheries around the world. The structure of our webinar is as follows. Our panel of experts will address three questions. The first question is, what impact do seismic surveys have on coastal communities, livelihoods, and marine life? What does the South African Constitution say about protecting coastal livelihoods and the environment? How sustainable are the courts in defending coastal communities, livelihoods, and marine life? We are going to have an interactive discussion with the speakers for 30 minutes, which will be followed by a 30-minute general discussion. So, Nonhle, based on your experiences working with coastal communities in the Eastern Cape on the Wild Coast, what impacts do seismic surveys have on coastal communities, livelihoods, and marine life? Over to you, Nonhle.
Thank you so much, Nobi. Yes, the impact that can happen if the seismic survey was taking place, it was going to be too much for the people that were living on the coast. Remember that a wild coast is known of the fishing area. All the fishermen are coming from different areas for doing fishing in our coastal. And now we have a lot of livelihood, which is the people that are dependent from the ocean for survival. Now, if you blast, as the seismic survey, they were going to do their own survey. They were planning to blast our ocean. That means many species from the ocean will be dying, including the fish. Now, the issue that we have is that we put more the national economy over our livelihood, over our local economy. As Shell also says that they are creating jobs. But what kind of jobs that when they're going to bring and it needs to destroy our own livelihood? Because for our issue when it comes to ocean is not only a hub to fish. I mean, a hub to eat. Also, it's part of spiritual place. It's a heritage. It's one of sacred place where our ancestors are residing there. Now, you destroy the whole chain, the whole system of life. It's not only the fish that you destroy when you do this seismic survey. And also the sound that was going to take place is going to scare everything also to the people that are living next to the coast. Those are the reasons that we say that, no, even survey alone, it's going to leave a negative impact, the negative impact that it will not going to be reversed.
Thank you so much, Sine Gugu. You also work on the Wild Coast, and based on your experiences, what are the impacts of seismic surveys on coastal communities as well as on marine life?
Thank you very much, Mbovu. The seismic exploration research is showing us that in the places where it has taken place during that seismic exploration, the catch or the fish that is available to the fishing communities declines sharply. So which means, therefore, people will not be able to earn their livelihood. Remember, for instance, within the Wild Coast where I am, people, they fish, they collect crayfish, they collect limpets, mussels, oysters, all of those things, and many other things like your squid. So therefore, if this business is allowed to go ahead, that's going to be a problem where the people who are dependent on the ocean are going to see a decline on the catch that is available to them. But of major importance is the fact that there is not only about the subsistence fishery where people go catch fish to eat. It's also about an economic activity. Coastal communities have just been working with the Department of Environmental Affairs in the fisheries section. They have encouraged the people to establish cooperatives. They then were given permits, which give them the right to be able to catch fish for commercial purposes. Some of those, if not most of those, they even promised boats which they would use when doing that. But both government has not yet delivered on those promises. Now, when you bring in the exploration for oil and gas, that brings in a contradiction from what has recently been planned by Environmental Affairs. And now you've got another government department that brings in now putting forward an interest to explore for oil and gas. Therefore, we say those interests, they are contradictory, because the one, if exploration goes ahead, then it's going to interfere with the fishing which people have been given. Of course, we know that government is saying no, they have technology that they would do this, but research, marine biologists have written affidavits to support our application to High Court to stop this. So we know that it is going to have an impact, and it was already proven in other areas where this has been done. It has been destructive. And the reason why it is destructive is because seismic exploration, the blasting with those air guns, destroys the very basis of the food chain within the ocean, your phytoplanktons, which is the base of the food chain to which the very small fish are dependent on. And when you disturb the base of the food chain within the oceanic ecosystem, then therefore that's going to affect the entire system. So therefore, that is putting, therefore, the people, and we know they use the argument that they will create jobs, not going to create jobs for all the coastal communities, even if they were going to. But what they are planning to do is not sustainable. The ocean has supported coastal communities for thousands of years. Even in our area, we have shell middens that show people who lived here during the last ice age, and there are lots of shells showing that they were dependent on the shellfish, which means the ocean is able to support coastal communities for many, many years. But if they explore for oil and then the oil is found, the greatest challenge is then what happens then to the livelihood. Even if jobs are created, no one, no company, no government would ever be able to create enough jobs to support all the coastal communities, all the people who are dependent on the ocean. That is why we say, in whatever way you look at it, seismic exploration for oil and gas in our oceans is not an ecologically sustainable economic activity. Therefore, it should be stopped because it is not in the interest of the coastal communities, but it's in the interest of the shareholders of Shell. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sinekuku. Muniba, you have worked with coastal communities here in the Western Cape for more than two decades now. In your view, what are the impacts of seismic surveys on coastal communities' livelihoods and marine life? Welcome, Christian. We are glad that you are able to connect now after some difficulty. So, Christian, I'm inviting you now to comment on the following question. Based on your experience working with coastal communities on the West Coast, what impacts do seismic surveys have on coastal communities' livelihoods and marine life? Thank you. Over to you, Christian.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Ngobe, and good afternoon to all the others, panelists, and all to all the other participants in the conference. Yes, my name is Christian Adams, and I am a small-scale fisher. And yes, the impact on coastal communities is quite significant in the fact that a lot of these surveys were done in other places in the world, and there's been effects on the marine and also on the production and migratory routes of some of the species that we are catching, like tuna and all of those things. And for us as small scale fishers, snook and tuna form an integral part of our livelihood, and snook is actually our mainstay of income throughout the year. And for us, snook is of such a manner that it forms a great part of our culture, our heritage as well, and our tradition in teaching and passing on the skill of fishing. So these seismic surveys stand the chance to irreparably harm that tradition and culture heritage that we have, and also the species in itself, as well as the environment in which we and the species operate in. So for us, it is important that we needed to be consulted before any of these seismic surveys have been conducted in our waters here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Christian. Moniba Isaacs, you have worked for more than 2 decades on the West Coast and elsewhere. We invite you now to provide your comments, particularly on the impact of seismic surveys on coastal communities and marine life. Over to you, Moniba.
Thank you, Ngobi. And also, it's an honor for me to kind of speak after we've had such good inputs from people who are working, whose boots are on the ground and really working with these issues. For me, it is very important that when we look at the judgment, and I'm going to reflect on the judgment, we look at the whole positionality of small-scale fishers. And if you look at small-scale fishers through the lenses of an oil and gas exploration company like Searcher and Shell, they are overlooked, they are undervalued, they are invisible to this companies coming in and looking at that. Even more, the arrogance of the company that was supposed to look at consultation with small-scale community didn't see it necessary to consult with this important group of people who make their livelihoods from the ocean, who respect the ocean culturally and spiritually, who source food as a form of food security and nutrition for themselves, and also as a form of income. All of this had been overlooked, but I'm not surprised. This is not only in the case of a consultancy firm who are lack consultation, or an outsider coming in and looking at surveys. It is also indicative of how the blue growth, the ocean economy, the commercial fisheries policy are all framed in such a way that it only look at the commercial sector. It benefits the commercial sector. It benefits aquaculture. It looks at adventure tourism. It overlooks small-scale fisheries. Even when we think of conservation and we think of marine protected areas, fences are put up to exclude people in terms of access. So in this year of the artisanal fisher year, according to the UN, I think it is an important to make it more visible. And it is interesting in South Africa, going back generations, going back from the First Nation people, we can trace that fishing has been an important part of coastal lives and livelihoods. Added to that, to link to what Christian is saying, I would say that it is definitely a case, looking at the judgment, it is definitely a case where we have a David and Goliath. And it is a story of the underdog, the invisible small-scale fishers taking on big companies. And really looking at how these surveys are impacting on a species like snook. And I would say that I think that Searcher has been slapped or vasgeklap met 'n pap snoek, which means that the significance of that species that had been overlooked and people to connect that species to their livelihood, to their food security, to the cultural practices, to the spirituality of fishing community, and the significance that Christian as a fisher on the West Coast is saying that this is the mainstay of their livelihood, and not considering that snook migrates from the southern part of Angola and come in and out during a season, and it's not necessarily sedentary species, it is a migratory species, and it is important that we connect that the kind of perspective of this judgment, making that significant of that the snook and the importance of these species that small scale fishers make a livelihood from has been overlooked. And the importance, I think, that often we're not recognizing is that ocean conservation and ocean sustainability and healthy ecosystems is an important part of that cultural, spiritual livelihoods of small-scale fishers. Thank you. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Muniba. I would like now to invite you, Vilmin, to tell us more about what does the South African Constitution say about protecting coastal livelihoods and the environment. Thank you. Over to you, Vilmin.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the opportunity. So, I mean, of course, the Constitution doesn't speak directly to coastal communities, but there are quite a number of rights that are triggered by these kinds of disputes that we've now seen on the West Coast and on the so-called Wild Coast. And as with everything, really, in our law, there's a balancing exercise needed between different rights. So I'm going to say something about the rights that were triggered here. I think that you've heard now time and again people mention consultation and that the fishers were invisible, they were not consulted. So the right in the Constitution that we have is a right to fair administrative action. Now that sounds like the most boring right imaginable, but it is an incredibly important one. It is kind of the cornerstone of the Constitution that takes us away from the authoritarian and abusive regime that we had before the Constitution. So this right talks about people in power making decisions, and it says that we, the powerless, the ones who are affected by those decisions, we have a right for those decisions to be fair, to be justified, and for the decision maker, in this case, Minister Mantashe, when granting a permit, for that decision maker to take into account relevant information, good information, the information that should inform these kinds of decisions. And so that is the right that on both sides of our country, coastal communities asserted to say, you did not do that, Minister Mantashe, because you granted a right without taking us into account at all, we as the most directly affected people. So that's the first one and an important one. But then there are a number of other more substantive rights that were triggered here. And I think we should go back really to the court case way back, Kenneth George in the late 2000s, which actually saw the recognition of the small scale fishing communities for the first time. And in that case was an equality court case, right? So these fishing communities went to the equality court and said the way that fishing rights are allocated in South Africa is discriminatory. It discriminates against us as small-scale fishing communities, against our culture, against our freedom to trade, our freedom to choose to be fishers, and our livelihoods, our right to food. And so very interestingly, in this judgment, Judge Tulare yesterday picked up on this right to equality and combined it with the right to fair administrative action and said the law applies equally to everyone. So if the law protects the commercial industry from arbitrary decisions and therefore makes searcher consult them in detail and respond to those consultations, then that equally applies to small-scale fishers. And so the actions of searcher was actually discriminatory. Then, of course, I've mentioned the right to food. I've mentioned the right to culture, which I think has become very important in these cases. The last one before I get to environment is the customary rights of these communities. So we know that through our constitution specifically independently recognizes customary rights of communities in South Africa. And it was a fishing case that asserted that through the Kongosi judgment in the SCA. And so these communities are also saying we have customary rights to fish. If you do things that limit those rights, then you immediately trigger the limitation of a constitutional right. And that's not something that you can do lightly. And then finally, of course, we have the right to environment in section 24. And I think what's very important in this kind of case is that the right to environment and sustainable development in our courts is understood as a people-centered notion, development and the right to environment both. And therefore, the argument really was it's about protecting the environment here, but also about protecting it in a way that recognizes the most vulnerable people who benefit from a good environment and are also the custodians of that environment. So, yeah, I'll stop there. Those are, I think, the key constitutional provisions.
Thank you so much, Wilmin. I would like to invite all panelists now to respond to our last question, which is how sustainable are court interdicts in defending coastal communities' livelihoods and marine lives? Perhaps we may start with you, Wilmin, on that question.
Sure. So it's a very good question and a pertinent one for us to ask ourselves right now. So these two very successful cases, these interdicts. So I should say, and I'm not going to go into the technical legal aspects of it, but an interdict is only a temporary measure pending the bigger case. In both Shell and Searcher, the bigger case is about reviewing the permits that was granted. So how sustainable is it? Well, not, these are only court actions that protect communities from the onslaught. These are not directly asserting positive rights of these communities. Of course, I think we have gotten judgments in both cases that really try to assert substantive rights, even though it's simply protecting the communities. But I would say the next frontier really is to move beyond procedural rights. So the right to consultation and the right to defend ourselves from the interference with our rights. And where we need to move, I think, in our litigation is to start getting substantive rights around climate change and the impact thereof, substantive rights around the right of small-scale fishing communities to practice the rights that nominally been recognized by the department and the minister, but in substance is still greatly lacking. So I think these were incredibly important cases to put them to put small-scale fisheries on the forefront. But the next frontier is to get proper, substantive implementation and realization of their rights.
Thank you very much, Wilmin. Nonle Butuma, if you could also respond to the same question about the sustainability of the court interdict. From where you stand, Pierre, what does the future look like?
Where I stand right now, the future, it looks darker, what I can say, because you can see the plans of the government are more fossil fuel, which is the big issue that we are facing with the global warming right now. It shows clear that our government is not there to mitigate the climate change. And our government is not there to promote the local economy. Now, the issue that we are facing is that our own government is more supporting the private sector, which is to destroy the livelihood, because private sector is not going to create jobs. As long as our government is pushing the private sector, I don't see how they're going to create jobs. And also, they are not looking at the sustainability way of doing development. Those are my fear. And also the human rights issue, because these developments are always override the human rights, because it's always putting the profit first before the people, which is my other worry. Although right now communities are always taking government in and out to court, which is another worry, that our democracy, that we are thinking is democracy, is democracy for few, not for all, because it shows that the state is more on the weak side, where they just turn a blind spot to the laws that is being implemented in order to protect the citizens. That is why I said, on my side, I see a more darker ahead of us. I see a more challenge as communities that we are facing to challenge this so-called democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nonte. We are slightly over time, and I think it's time that we look at the questions and have our panelists respond to the questions that have been raised. The first one is from Mbulelo. Mbulelo says, as usual with this government, the left hand does not know what the right hand is doing. And then the question is, what are the prospects for fully implementing the One Environmental Management System? I invite our panelists to respond to that question. And perhaps we may start with Snekuku. Thank you, Snekuku.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Thanks, Nobi. Nobi, in terms of what the One and Environmental Management System, yes, that is in place now. But the challenge we have in South Africa is bigger than One Environmental System. If one was to look at how the ruling party deploys ministers, we have seen since 1994 that there is a growing trend where the government is always deploying a weaker, in terms of political influence, a weaker candidate on the environment department and a much stronger, like for instance, if you're looking now, you have got Gwede Mandashe, who is the Minister for Mineral Resources and Energy. And then you have Barbara Creecy, and Gwede Mandashe is the chairperson of the ruling party. So the tendency is of making sure that the environment, we know that if we're looking in the previous years, the environment department has even been given to Martina Sanskalpik. So there is a tendency to give that environment department somebody who is less influential in terms of the political decisions. And therefore, we know that the cabinet sits in what is called in this country cabinet lekgotla, and decisions are made there, and votes have to be made when decisions are made. Unfortunately, we can see that. I've never been to that meeting, but I can already see that. So decisions are being made there that would undermine the environment, no matter there is a minister, there are laws and all of that. And it is therefore important and significant that we, as South Africans, as the public, as individuals, that we are able to use the constitution to use the legislations we have, the statutes that we have at our disposal, to go to court, to use the constitution. The legal firms like Legal Resource Center, they are never going to be able to help us unless we stand up and we are able to give them an opportunity to use these laws in court in order to create precedents that could be used to protect our livelihoods, our environment. So the most important thing is for us to be able as individuals, as citizens, as public organizations, to go up to court so that we give opportunities for these laws to be tested and to be used to argue our position so that we create a precedent that could be used in future to protect our livelihoods and our environment. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sinegugu. I invite other panelists to comment briefly on the question. If not, then I go to the following comment, essentially, from N. Not. N is saying, so, are we talking about extinction of species, extinction of small-scale fishers and livelihoods, and constitutional rights to food, extinction of indigenous customary cultural and spiritual practices, extinction of participative democracy and people-centered social and climate justice, including fair administrative practices and equity. Thank you so much, Anne, for that comment. And we have a few comments, but let me hand over to our panelists to respond to your comment. Okay, maybe from you, Christian, about the extinction of rights, you know, customary rights, the erosion of it, which is essentially the erosion of democratic principles. In response to the above comment, what would you say?
Yes, thank you, Ngobe. Yes, for us, it's basically a question of this is a fight that has been started not a couple of years ago, but four centuries ago. And 400 years ago, my forefather started fighting against Jan van Riebeeck became the colonialist. And then from there, this fight carried on into different sets of times through apartheid. And now we as this generation are still fighting the same fight to get that recognition that small-scale fishers need within the history of South Africa and also within the future of South Africa. Because all over the world we have, since 1981, we have had studies showing that it's only in small-scale fisheries that there is an increase in employment. So if we are going to look against all of these arguments that the minister are making, loss of jobs and loss of this and loss of that, if they give us as small-scale fishers the proper support in order to create those opportunities for employment, which we will be able to do, because subsequently, even through the coronavirus pandemic, what we've seen in the lockdowns, where did people flee to when they couldn't go to the normal jobs that they were working under? Without the lockdowns, they came to the oceans, and us as fishers still continue to support and allow them to be able to provide and put food on their tables. So for us, it's not a matter of if we are looking at an extinction. For us, it's a matter of continuing with this fight for the recognition of the small-scale fishers. And subsequently with that, we will be continuing to look after the oceans and to also look after the environment and the species that the environment hosts. Because we've been doing this, like I said, for 400 years. And it's only through the last century, from the early 1950s, that this huge industrial exploitation started. So we were the custodians of the oceans until that time that the apartheid regime decided to rape the ocean to the extent in which it's still being pilfered at this very moment through those very same companies that are responsible for the decimation of our resource in the manner than which they are doing it. But still, we are the ones that are looking after the protection We are the first ones to respond to a marine disaster, as we've seen just recently in Helens Bay. Who were the first people that were there on the scene? It was the small-scale fishers that was there. Not the scientists, not the big companies. Who are the people that are most concerned about these issues? It's the small-scale fishers. So if people are thinking that we are looking after this ocean in a manner to just be a poacher or whatever they want to call it, it is these very industrial companies that are doing the things that that people or the system are blaming us for. In terms of the administration and those type of things, just one small comment to say that currently our small-scale fisheries department consists of less than 10 people to look after four provinces. And if we look at the amount of people that service the industrial sector within the department, you can see the huge discrepancy and the huge bias towards whereby the department wants to give their support to. And I think I must stop there for now because there are much more that we can add to that. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Christian, for your contribution. Wilmin, your hand is up. Maybe you want to respond to this comment. Thank you.
I maybe want to respond to, a number of comments, and people are asking about how to further assert these substantive rights. And I want to say something that has kind of been on my mind throughout this process of these two court cases. And so I've worked with small-scale fishing communities for the last 11 or 12 years, and they've done a number of court cases where they were able to assert substantive rights and extraordinary victories. But no one cared, and they got no attention. And it's not that they didn't try. So on the one hand, it's wonderful that they have now become the champions of a bigger and maybe a different fight. For them, of course, it's about the impact on them, but it's clear that, you know, they've got an amazing support throughout the country because, you know, it links to people's greater concern about the environment. I am concerned that when the environment conversation moves on, then the support to them will also move on. And I think that's really, you know, we talk about the company that rendered them invisible, which is absolutely true, but many society has in a sense also rendered them invisible for a very long time. I don't think it's only the company or only the government. I think we've for a very long time completely ignored these communities. And it is something that requires some introspection from all of us, I think. So a celebration with also kind of a pause as to why that is. And the support that these communities need is a mobilization around their rights that need their recognition. And so I would really like to see this renewed, these bonds that have now been made in this support network that it continues and that it focuses on what these communities need, whether that has got to do with a bigger environmental discourse or not. So that, I think, you know, litigation, there's a question about how do we get the substantive rights. We've done that for the fishers, but because there's no, they struggle so much to get public support, to get, you know, recognition amongst everyday people, they struggle to have those rights implemented. So that is key, and I think it's something we should reflect on.
Thank you so much, Wilmin. We have another question here from Luyiso Dunga. He's directing, he or she is directing the question to Mr. Adams and Nontle. One is, have you given any thoughts to what we could do to ensure that we protect the local communities and the ocean environment? And the second question from Luyiso is directed to Wilmin. Is there any constitutional provision that ensures that these big companies pay reparations to communities they put in harm's way? And then Luiso is thankful. Perhaps we may start with you, Christian, in terms of what the wider public could do in support.
Yes, thank you very much, Mnove. Yes, for us as small-scale fishers, I think Wilmina did touch on that, and that it is only through our, when we have our public actions also, and that also that when we write articles to, these are practical examples of what I'm saying as to what can happen in terms of support. It's to say that when we are writing articles to newspapers, comment on those articles. When we are speaking on social media about these things, look at, for instance, this year is the International Year for Artisanal Fisheries. It's the first time that the United Nations have declared any year the International Year for Artisanal Fisheries. Now, this is the very this is the best year for the wider public to come out in support of small-scale fishers, because it's such a, it's been recognized on an international level. But for us, also on to the question of Luiso, is that we've been protecting the environment for centuries, and through that protection of the environment, we've been looking after our communities for centuries as well, and through that, we've been able to keep the tradition, the culture, and the customary right of fishing. We've been able to keep it alive through all the struggles that we've had. Like I said earlier, colonialism, apartheid, no recognition of rights. We've been fighting to keep this manner of fishing alive. And we are still doing it in the manner in which the Khoi and the San peoples did it 400 years ago, by looking after the environment, by looking how we are fishing, through when we are fishing. We've been the ones that started to implementing seasons. We are the ones that started to implementing size limits. Don't catch that fish. Don't catch this fish. Don't catch a lobster when it's in berry. This is one of the very earliest lessons that I've learned from my grandfather in terms of protecting the ocean and protecting the species within. When he told me at the age of 7 years, hey, Christian, that lobster, you can't eat it and you can't take it home because you need to put it back in the water because it's got a soft shell and it's burying eggs. And that's when I started to know that, hey, we need to look after the environment. Now, I'm a fourth generation fisher, and that skill of fishing has been passed down from generation to generation until it's now. Through all the oil and gas speaking, I hear that we are going to be skilled, we are going to be upskilled in all of this. I am very skilled. I am very knowledgeable in the act or in the occupation of fishing. Don't try to come and change me to make me something else. And that is what we've been trying to tell the ministers. We've been trying to tell the people out there, is that when you look at the West Coast, the history of fishing is part of this West Coast, the very existence of the West Coast. And then now we have many instances through the actions of our government that this history will be ruined or will be lost for everybody. So we want to have tourists coming to the West Coast, look at nice fishing villages, but we don't want the tourists to meet or see the fishers or the fishing communities. Only the villages, yeah, it's like a dead remnant that is standing there. Yeah, there used to be a thriving fisheries here. Is this what they want to tell us? No. We've started this fight 400 years ago, and we will continue this fight for another 400 if it need be.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Christian. Muniba, I like to invite you to comment on what has been said, what has been posed as questions. Over to you, Muniba.
Thank you, Nobi. I think that, you know, my worry, like Wilmin, had been you have successes in the court and you have wins, important wins with interim interdicts, and you are able to sway the minister to say not to cut West Coast rock lobster on an annual basis. But in reality, what are the bread and butter issues for these communities to thrive? Number one, I go back to snook. Snook is a very significant species for small-scale fishes. Industrial trawlers are targeting snook and declare it as bycatch. When is the government going to stop allowing big industrial fishing companies to target schools of snook that are important, a livelihood, food security for small-scale fishers? Another factor is that in a study that we've done last year on the African food systems, we focused on Lamberts Bay. We have found that through COVID, that the social reproductive role of women in fishing is becoming less and less, and they've become invisible. The fish is not able to stay in the community. It is taken out of the community because there are no infrastructural support for communities to store fish for a longer period of time. So stop industrial fisheries from targeting snook. Provide cold storage for fishers on harbors, and that would increase work for fishing communities. With the snook, you make lung sauce. And that means that a family can eat that fish for a whole week because you can make a different variety of that fish. It is an important form of nutrition for communities. But coming back, let's put that all aside. It is so important that we're not using small-scale fishing communities to go against oil and gas, and we use it in terms of their livelihoods and the practices of their livelihoods, because that is inherent a problem for conservation organizations. And we need to really unpack how we view conservation and how conservation is really practiced. Because I tell you, I've been in so many meetings where small-scale fishers are known as the poachers. They are the one who are extracting more than what they should. And I think it is important that we bring in the social justice rights and access of small-scale fishers have been recognized. But we need to really unravel how we practice conservation, how conservation is perceived, and who is and that conservation is seen that it is a living a thing between communities and the ocean, and not disconnected, not forced, that your access is not allowed, and that we need to bring social justice movements in South Africa to start recognizing that these rights is also important. We need to bring the justice and link blue justice to the issue of small-scale fisheries, because we are fighting a bigger battle of oil, gas, aquaculture, sustainability, exclusion of small-scale fishes. So I agree that with Nonkle, we are in for a bigger battle, and our space are getting smaller, and we are becoming more invisible as people. So we must stop using small-scale fishes for your own agenda. Start looking at investing and supporting small-scale fishes to practice their livelihood, to support their value chains, to rehabilitate these communities, and not just go as a tourist to kind of view small-scale fishes, but actually buy from them. And I think it is important that we reshape how we think about small-scale fishes.
Thank you so much, Muniba. I would like to invite Nonhle and Sinebuku to make closing remarks. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, what I can say in my closing is that now let's put the environment, when we said environment, including the human being, because the issue that we have
the human being is excluded when we talk about the environment. And also, let's put the sustainable development. And also, let's include the communities. Let's include people in the development. Because we are on this challenge because there is a huge exclusion of our communities. Now, we are no longer part of decision-making. Somebody from above decide on behalf of us. Now, let's bring the same democracy that we were hoping for. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nontle. Christian Adams, your closing remarks, please.
Yes, I would just like to continue on the discussion that we're currently having, and that I totally agree with Nontle is that when we're speaking about the environment, we need to include human beings as well. Because if we look at it, if we are speaking about an ecosystem approach of which our government is speaking about, we are looking at this approach from a sort of view that, yes, actually, we are part and included in this ecosystem that we are harvesting from. But we are not being respected in the same manner in which the rest of the ecosystem is being respected. Yet I'm going to reiterate what I said earlier. We are the ones that have been the custodians of these oceans since time immemorial. When they started coming to our shores, they found us here looking after these resources. And to the general public out there and to people out there, to say that when you see us in the media, when you see us asking for support from different areas or from different platforms, or even from different areas within the country as well, when we are protesting on our beaches, do come and join us. Do come and show us that support. And do come and show us that you are actually recognizing that there is a sector and still operating and thriving is the small-scale fishery sector in South Africa. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Christian. Wilmin, your closing remarks, please.
Thank you. Maybe my closing remark will be a question that you actually asked me in preparation for this webinar, Chair, which was about would this case have been possible 50 years ago or before the Constitution? And, you know, we often talk about the limitations of the Constitution, which and there are many. We can just look at our society to see that. But no, this kind of case would not have been possible 50 years ago because, you know, we did not have a Bill of Rights and our courts were not required to weigh up the commercial interests of a company that are considerable financial interests to weigh that up against constitutional rights and would never have found that the constitutional rights of anyone, of the most vulnerable, trump whatever commercial rights there are. And I think this is really, really significant and something we should not underestimate and just build on, really. And to say, finally, court cases are great, but they don't change the world. The world is changed by people and our minds as a society changing. And that's maybe this is a contribution to that, but that's what we need. We need changed minds. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Wilmin. And thank you so much to all our panelists and all our guests on YouTube, all the students from different universities, from environmentalists as well who have joined, from people in the NGOs, in the private sector, and in government. And let us please keep talking about these issues. As Wilmin has said, you know, if it was 50 years ago, perhaps we wouldn't be having these types of platforms. So we should embrace these kinds of negotiations. So on behalf of the University of Western Cape Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies, I would like to bring this webinar to a close, and I wish you all well. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Just Us and the Climate, a production by the Climate Justice Coalition. To find out more about the Coalition and their work to promote climate justice, visit climatejusticecoalition.org. This podcast is made possible thanks to the financial support of the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.